Benjamin Netanyahu dissolves his war cabinet.
Netanyahu's extremist partners, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, could now perhaps have more influence.
Plus, an international peace summit for Ukraine wraps up in Switzerland.
We are at a war, and we don't have time for prolonged war. Moving to peace means acting fast. Preparations will take months, not years.
And later, the latest from Kyiv, and a look at an Iranian prisoner swap that's raising some eyebrows on social media. Today is Monday, June 17th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today's show in the Middle East, where Israel's military has announced what they're calling a tactical pause in daytime fighting around a critical aid route in Gaza. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
The Israel Defense Forces released a video this weekend claiming to show elite units raiding what it described as terrorist infrastructure in Gaza, yielding large quantities of weapons. VOA cannot independently verify this or other IDF content. Those IDF raids are just the latest in the Israel-Hamas conflict, now in its ninth month following Hamas's October 7th terror attacks on Israel. Then the Western-identified terror group and its allies stormed the border with Israel, killing 1,200 and kidnapping some 250 people. Since then, Israel struck back hard in Palestinian territories, killing more than 37,000, mostly civilians, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. The United Nations has for months warned of catastrophe and famine in Gaza as Israel choked off entry points where vital food, water, fuel, and medicine would normally pass. But as of Sunday, the IDF announced a daytime tactical pause in its military offensive in the southern Gaza Strip. From 5 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon and until further notice, the pause aims to grant safe passage of aid trucks bringing much-needed supplies to Gaza. Welcome news to aid groups struggling for months to deliver life-saving supplies.
Here we have really a protection disaster and a water and sanitation catastrophe. People are camping on the streets, on the beach, at best with some piece of shelter. We were driving through rivers of sewage.
News of the tactical pause comes as the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced 8 of its soldiers died in fighting in the Rafah area of the Gaza Strip in what was the deadliest such attack by Hamas in months. Netanyahu blamed the fatalities on a roadside bomb or anti-tank missile. Meanwhile, Israelis continued their weekly protests against Netanyahu's government, calling for both an end to the war and the freeing of hostages taken by Hamas. News of the protected movement of humanitarian aid comes as Muslims celebrate Eid al-Adha, or the Fast of Sacrifice. It takes on a new meaning this year following months of war where instead of celebrating in their homes, many Palestinians now pray atop piles of rocks and rubble. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Along with the localized pause in fighting, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved his war cabinet. For the very latest, I'm joined by Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, it means that the decisions about the war will no longer be in this smaller forum of the war cabinet, which Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, the two former chiefs of staff who pulled out of the government last week, were part of. And at least from all of the reports, they had a somewhat moderating influence on some of the decisions, at least. And Netanyahu's extremist partners, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, could now perhaps have more influence. Ben-Gvir very much wanted a seat on this war cabinet. And he said that now that, there was now room since Gantz and Eisenkot had left. And then Netanyahu dissolved the war cabinet, which kind of could have been his message to Ben-Gvir. clear that he actually doesn't want him on the war cabinet. Israeli officials said that the decisions will be made, Netanyahu and the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and then will be taken to the security cabinet where Ben-Gvir and Smotrich do have seats.
Does the dissolution of the war cabinet portend any bigger changes to the government? I know you and I have spoken before about the Israeli public wanting to see elections sooner rather than later.
So Netanyahu still has a majority of 64 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, which he had before Gantz brought his National Unity Party with 12 people into the government. So he still has a majority, but instead of having a majority, a very comfortable majority, he has a more narrow majority. That said, I don't think it's going to lead all that quickly to new elections. I mean, polls show the Israeli public does want new elections. In the last few days, we've seen some demonstrations of thousands, some people say tens of thousands of people who are calling for new elections, in fact, have blocked roads and things like that. But I think unless you're going to see hundreds of thousands of people coming into the streets, and the response of Netanyahu usually is, well, as long as there's a war going on, we can't go to new elections. So I don't think there are going to be new elections anytime very soon.
And speaking of the Israeli public and public opinion, how are they taking this news that the war cabinet has been dissolved? Are they seeing this as a failure of Netanyahu to keep it together, or rather a failure of the two that left to sort of get on board and get with the program?
So I think they're kind of mixed feelings. You know, there are the public support for Netanyahu is low. Two-thirds of the public says they don't have a lot of confidence in him. Among the Arab public, it's something like three-quarters. At the same time, this move was not really a surprise. You know, it was kind of expected that once they left, Netanyahu would dissolve the war cabinet. There does seem to be, however, an increasing sort of movement. Again, it's slow. It's not a huge movement yet, but of people saying, that they want there to be new elections. A new poll that just came out today also said that 60% of the public support the latest ceasefire deal that's on the table that President Biden, has released, saying it's an Israeli proposal and calling on the world to pressure Hamas. And basically, that would mean a ceasefire and end to the war in exchange for the release of all of the hostages.
And speaking of ceasefire, it's not a total ceasefire, but what they're calling a tactical pause in fighting along a key route near the Kerem Shalom border crossing into Gaza. Can you tell us what's happening there, how large an area it is, and what we can expect to happen?
Well, yeah, there's something, this whole thing is a bit strange because the announcement came from the Israeli army, not from the government. And then Netanyahu in the cabinet meeting said, this is the first I've heard of it. But basically the army said that during the daytime hours from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., they would pause operations along this corridor. So it's not a huge area, but it's a corridor that goes near the city of Rafah, in order to allow more humanitarian aid to come in. Apparently, there are hundreds and hundreds of trucks that Israel has inspected and is allowing in.
So is this a tacit admission by the Israelis that there is a problem with humanitarian aid in Gaza and that they can, in fact, do more?
Well, yes, but I mean, what Israel says is that if Egypt hadn't closed the Rafah side of the border, there wouldn't be an issue, and that they're responding to that. Israel continues to maintain that there's enough aid coming in. They say the problem is the distribution by the UN, so it's not clear how this pause would help that issue of distribution. They also say that Hamas is stealing the aid. But I think there also is a recognition by Israel that whether or not it's Israel's fault, Israel's being blamed for the humanitarian situation there.
And it's a busy Monday. The final thing I want to discuss with you is farther north, Israel's border with Lebanon. Hezbollah has been increasingly antagonistic towards Israel. What's the latest from there?
Well, Amos Hochstein, you know, the Biden administration's point man on this conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, is in Israel today and then going to Lebanon. And there are fears on all sides that what has been kind of a simmering conflict could explode into a full-blown war. The Israeli army spokesman warned Hezbollah against that. And it's one of these situations where neither Israel nor Hezbollah wants a full-scale war, but they've been kind of inching towards it. Hezbollah has 150,000 rockets that could hit all of Israel. So if there was this kind of a war, it would really have a major effect on the Israeli public, even more than the war in Gaza. And at the same time, Israel would hit all kinds of Lebanese infrastructure. The other issue is that on both sides of the border, there are 150,000 people who can't go back to their homes. And yet, over the weekend, Nasrallah gave a speech in which he said that any ceasefire in Lebanon is tied to a ceasefire in Gaza, and that as long as there's no ceasefire in Gaza, there won't be a ceasefire in Lebanon. And Hezbollah has been firing heavier missiles and things at Israel, and Israel has been responding in kind. So the tensions between the two sides have definitely ratcheted up over the past week or so.
And we'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you, Steve.
In Switzerland, 78 of the roughly 100 countries attending the two-day international summit on peace in Ukraine signed a document saying that Ukraine's territorial integrity should be the basis for a peace agreement with Russia, and that Kyiv should enter into a dialogue with Moscow on ending the war. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen cautioned on Sunday that though the summit has brought peace closer to Ukraine, real peace will not be achieved in one step.
Our support and this peace summit here brings real peace closer. The goal is a just, comprehensive, and lasting peace. This would finally bring an end to the oppression and suffering of the Ukrainian people. This would reaffirm Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And this would restore the primacy of international law and the UN Charter. The path to real peace requires patience and determination.
For his part, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said there are two ways to force Russia into peace. The first is diplomatic, and the second is with a strong defense and a powerful army.
We are at a war, and we don't have time for prolonged war. Moving to peace means acting fast. Preparations will take months, not years. So, when the action plans for peace are ready, and when every step is worked out, the path will be opened for the second peace summit, and thus for ending this war, for a just and lasting peace.
Zelensky did not say whether he was prepared to engage with Russian President Vladimir Putin directly in talks to end the conflict, though he has in the past ruled out direct talks with him. Russia was not invited to attend the summit, while China, Russia's key ally, did not attend. The Kremlin said on Sunday that Ukraine should reflect on Putin's demands that Ukraine drop its bid to join NATO and give up the four provinces that Russia now claims. And following that peace summit in Switzerland, the war still grinds on, with fresh attacks that leave tens of thousands without power. VOA's Lori London has an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Yes, the Russian forces continue the shelling of the entire territory of Ukraine. It's happening over the weekend and during the previous week and the week that just began. As we are talking, rescue operation is undergoing in the Poltava region, which is central eastern part of the country. We just received information that early Monday, Russian forces launched missile attack of this area, of this region. At this point, we know about at least 9 people wounded and 53 3,000 people who do not have electricity as a result of the attack. The attack hit the civilian infrastructure, critical infrastructure, as well as residential areas. The rescue operation, which is ongoing, is to save, mainly to save people who remain under the rubble, and of course also to restore the electricity to such huge amount of people.
And this has been an ongoing problem already with Russia targeting Ukrainian energy infrastructure across the country. So this is just adding to what was already a very big problem.
Yeah, well, situation in general with electricity in Ukraine is extremely tough, and it's getting worse. If we're talking about previous week, according to Ukrainian officials, energy officials, it was really close to critical. And this upcoming week, everyone expects the situation might get even worse.
And the peace summit over the weekend, any reaction on the ground to how people felt, expectations met? How are they assessing the whole event?
Actually, here in Ukraine, people did not expect that this event will be as successful as it turned to be. A lot of people had skepticism around it, so people did not expect any, you know, particular decisions to be made, and not precisely positive attitude towards it. However, as this summit took place, a lot of discussion is around the fact that it was a very successful diplomatic event that Ukraine managed to organize. In terms of diplomatic matter, it was definitely a little victory for Ukraine. So many countries joined, so many countries at the end joined the final communique, and actually Ukrainians are quite hopeful that this could be the first step towards future meetings on real peace agreement that might be happening. However, a lot of people also understand that Russia probably will not pay attention to what the summit that happened in Switzerland, as Russian officials already said that they're not even going to consider this as any steps toward the peace talks. However, Ukrainians and Ukrainian officials believe that such strong support of so many countries will make a difference and will make Russia reconsider probably in the future, at least will demonstrate to Russia that they are definitely in the minority, not in the majority, and that the whole world continue to support Ukraine. So I can say that the result of the summit is more positive than a lot of people here in Ukraine expected.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laurie.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Iran and Sweden announce a prisoner swap. We'll get the details in a few minutes. But before that, there's some news from East Asia. Russian President Vladimir Putin will pay a state visit to North Korea from June 18th to the 19th at the invitation of the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. This according to North Korea's state-run television. Kim extended the invite to Putin during his visit to Russia's Far East last September. Putin has not visited Pyongyang since 2000. Meanwhile, the Kremlin said on Monday that contacts have taken place with the United States over a possible prisoner exchange involving Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, but that they should remain far from the public eye. Dmitry Peskov is the Kremlin spokesperson. He confirmed that the talks are indeed taking place, but they need to be conducted privately. Gershkovich was detained by the Federal Security Services on March 29th of 2023 on charges of espionage that carry up to 20 years in prison. Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal, the newspaper he works for, and the U.S. government have repeatedly denied the charges. And in other prisoner swap news, Iran and Sweden have carried out a prisoner exchange that's earned both governments a strong rebuke from Iranian opposition and rights activists, both inside and outside of Iran. On Saturday, Sweden released former Iranian prison official Hamid Nouri, whom a Swedish court had sentenced to life in prison in 2022 for his role in mass killings of political prisoners in 1988. In return, Iran freed two Swedish citizens whom it had jailed on national security charges that Stockholm has rejected as bogus. Sagi Lagahi is a multimedia journalist with the VOA Persian service. My colleague Micah Lippin asked her what social media users inside Iran were saying about the deal.
Michael, the reactions inside Iran were mostly dissatisfaction. They consider it as an appeasement with Islamic Republic. Some people say this exchange of prisoners after the death of Raisi and Amir Abdullahian, the president and the foreign minister who died a few weeks ago, shows that these kind of negotiations actually led by Khamenei himself.
When you talk about dissatisfaction, have you seen those social media users inside Iran criticizing the Iranian government for essentially taking Western hostages in order to secure the release of an Iranian man who was sentenced to life in prison for his role in mass killings in 1988?
People are not happy dealing with Islamic regime. As we can see, the critics themselves are not addressing the Islamic Republic. They talk to Swedish government and Western officials instead.
So they're directing their ire more at the Swedish authorities, it seems, than the Iranian authorities. There's also strong criticism that I've seen of this prisoner exchange from the Iranian diaspora, which, as we all know, is quite a fractured community of people with very different ideologies. But when you were researching your own recent story about the reaction to this prisoner exchange, what did you notice from the Iranian diaspora about any themes in their commentary on this issue?
Well, most people in the diaspora says the release of Hamid Nouri, who was engaged in the execution of thousands of political prisoners in the 1980s, is kind of insult to the rule of law and human rights. In this case, different viewpoints of the opposition agree that the Islamic Republic should not be allowed to continue taking hostages and use it to take advantage from the West.
Can you give an example of a social media comment that drew your attention on this topic?
Yeah, I can say about Prince Reza Pahlavi's statement about it, who said that the Swedish released a war criminal, Hamid Nouri, who is an affront to the rule of law, human rights, and basic decency. And I saw that many people had same statements, like Shirin Ebadi, who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. She had the kind of same statement about it.
Well, Hamid Nouri has returned to Iran. And what kind of reception did he get from the authorities when he arrived back?
Yeah, I think it was predictable how the Islamic Republic would welcome one of its agents, yes, by rolling out the red carpet for him. Obviously, the regime claims Hamid Nouri is innocent, and the Swedish court sentence is illegal.
How much do you think the Islamic Republic authorities care about the reactions that we've been discussing from, you know, people inside Iran who are criticizing the Swedish authorities, and from people in the Iranian diaspora who are criticizing both sides? Does this make any difference to them?
I think they don't care at all. As I said, the regime that supports terrorism and kills its own people does not care about it. And I think because of it, people addressing Swedish government and officials, not Islamic Republic.
That's Michael Lippin speaking with Asaghi Lagahi of VOA's Persian service. And that ends today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.